Yes, welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, the rich and powerful are schmoozing at the luxury Davos resort in Switzerland this weekend, the people who really run the Western world. Headline in the Independent tomorrow, top Tories enjoyed jovial Davos fondue night out just hours before Britain receives dire economic news. So, the Davos World Economic Forum, but who runs Davos? A highly critical article is removed on Thursday this week from the Bloomberg website, so we are going to have a good look at it. Also, the cuts kicking in up in Cadbury Heath, the post office and youth centres, the latest for under the potential access we hear from the local council. We hear highly dangerous nuclear shipments passing through Bristol Temple Meads every week. Have you felt the warm glow on a Wednesday afternoon? Well, we hear from two nuclear train chasers. And the notorious death of government scientist David Kelly back in 2003. We hear from someone else who believes he was murdered. That's barrister Michael Shrimpton, giving us a possible nuclear charged motive. And as ever, Martin Summers taking us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first this week, I'm joined by Martin Farmer, who's councillor, Labour councillor for Cadbury Heath. Hi Martin, welcome to Drive.
Hello Tony, thanks for inviting me.
Now first of all, what's going on in Cadbury Heath with the youth centre and the post office?
Well, it's first of all, yes, thanks for inviting me back. It's always good to talk about things north of the border up in South Gloucestershire. In Cadbury Heath, there's a few good things that have gone on just recently. We've had some investment in the local Cadbury Heath Hall, which was really bucked the trend, and the local parish council actually made an investment there, £150,000, created for a few jobs for a few months while that was renovated. But the things we're actually fighting now, one is the youth centre, the other is the post office. The youth centre, which many youngsters enjoy going to throughout the week, and also the post office, which has been serving the community, well, probably since Cadbury Heath, as soon as Cadbury Heath existed, and is now under threat of being closed.
Okay, so in the area of Cadbury Heath, you have a cinema, sports centres, sports clubs. There's plenty for young people to do. So why focus on local government-funded youth centre, especially during austerity times? I mean, you know, there's plenty for the youngsters to do.
Yeah.
Why do they need a youth centre?
I possibly should have explained. I think Cadbury Heath's one of the five priority neighbourhoods in South Gloucestershire. So it's got its unfair share of deprivation, unemployment, and what have you. And literally because of that, and we heard earlier on about how generous David Cameron was by raising unemployment benefit by £1 a day. Literally, some of the youngsters in and around Cadbury Heath cannot afford to go to the local View cinema or join some of the sports centres. So their way of sort of releasing their energy and mixing with their, you know, with their friends is actually down at the local youth centre, which gives them sort of some time out and gives them a safe place to go.
That's it, of course. You know, many of the activities for young people, they cost, don't they? And of course, that's part of the kudos for youngsters, is they're doing something which is costing something, and it's almost like you know, keeping up with the Joneses. You know, my kids do this, and I do that. But what about the children that simply don't have any money to spend?
Well, exactly. While some of the Tory leadership are having fun in Davos, I mean, there's young people in Cadbury Heath. I mean, just recently we tried to arrange a trip for them which was going to be heavily subsidised. We're going to try and get funding for it, and they had to contribute literally just £5, and because of the economic situation that we're now facing, a lot of those children could not afford or their parents could not afford the £5 just to go on a trip. Obviously, their parents, you know, are surviving hand to mouth as the youngsters are, and I find that just completely criminal. And then on top of that, the South Gloucestershire Council then come along and say, well, actually, your youth centre, yeah, we're going to fund it in 2013, but we're only going to fund it for two nights a week. So then, kids, you can go in, entertain yourself on the streets.
What's your experience of what children do get up to if they haven't got any money and there aren't any facilities for them, they can't afford to go to the cinema, and the youth centre's being closed down? What do they get up to?
I think most of the time, and I know we're facing, you know, it's quite cold weather at the time, but literally the young people are trying to you know entertain themselves either in their own homes or literally out on the streets. I think there is another dimension to this as well, because it's not just a building and a youth centre, but there's some very good youth workers actually working in Cadbury Heath Youth Centre. You know, some youngsters have actually got problems both at school, at home, and the youth centre workers are there to actually help them and actually provide some support and some guidance and some counselling as well. So it's more than maybe just being with their friends. But of course, the cuts that are now being imposed by South Gloucestershire, those youth centre workers are now having to actually reapply for their jobs, and a number of them will actually be made redundant, which again is a travesty, especially when they're actually bringing so much good to those youngsters and also helping the community as well.
Now, on the 5th of December, you've very sneakily snuck in some information for me here, because South Gloucestershire Council said, apparently, that it would fund youth centres in its priority neighbourhoods, so Cadbury Heath Youth Centre should be safe.
Yeah, and there was a big debate, I think, amongst all parties in South Gloucestershire. And of course, South Gloucestershire, there's a Conservative Liberal Democrat majority, and they decided that youth centres in the five priority neighbourhoods would then be funded just for two nights a week. So we've got buildings there standing empty for the rest of the week, and the youngsters have only got can only use it for two nights a week. I think, as I said earlier on, the youth centre workers, a number of them now, because you don't need so many youth centre workers to run these centres just for two nights a week, they're having to reapply for the jobs. A number of them are actually going to lose their jobs. And I think on top of that, the youth centre in Cadbury Heath is due for demolition at some point in time, which we don't know when. South Gloucestershire Council haven't actually come out with the facts yet. And that youth centre will actually be demolished.
It's one of those things that, I mean, when you're driving around or going around on the bus around Bristol and around this area, you see quite a few of these old youth centres. I mean, they sort of boarded up, and I hope that one doesn't go down that route. Let's hope. But your local MP up there is MP Chris Skidmore, who's on my list of city slackers because he doesn't return my phone calls and he doesn't return my emails inviting him on this show. He must be supporting your activities, surely.
I think we must be in the same boat then, because he doesn't return my phone calls or my emails. It's interesting with
he's a Kingswood Conservative MP, isn't he, Chris Skidmore?
He is. It's interesting with Chris Skidmore. He's usually see him around Cadbury Heath at a time of election time, and in the council elections in May 2010, he was actually photographed with Baroness Vorsey, who we all know and love.
She was Conservative chair of the Conservative Party.
Exactly. They all went to Cadbury Heath with local councillors, and what they were threatening to do was actually close the youth centre, and they said move it into a new building, which the local residents actually got up in arms about that, because the problem is it's all promises. And typical with Chris Skidmore, it was more electioneering by Chris Skidmore, and he's done this with regard to a few projects in and around the area.
Well, no, actually, Bristol City, he's not the only person. Bristol City Council, I can remember back, 20 years ago, they closed down the little theatre on Colson Street, which was used by amateur dramatic groups right from the, you know, sort of 20, 30 miles around the city, saying we're going to refurbish it, and it never reopened again.
Exactly,
I mean,
exactly.
Be careful, folks out there. If your council says they want to refurbish something, don't let them close it down, because it may be the death knell for it. To the post office, in these days of the internet and electronic banking, having a post office on your doorstep is a luxury for people in Cadbury Heath, but surely, I mean, this is an essential thing to have. How can they be talking about getting rid of the post office?
Yeah, exactly. The way it's been constructed in Cadbury Heath, you've got the post office and what was a shop next door, and it's actually surrounded by elderly people's homes. So it's something accessible for elderly people to use, and they do use it extensively. And I think the other thing is also is that I think we do take it for granted that people do regularly use the internet. There's a number of people who actually don't use the internet or don't actually have access to it.
So this is going to a cost cutter store, is that right? I mean, you know, surely people are just going to have to change their habits. They're going to have to go down the road to cost cutters. It's not that far.
I think the problem there is that and you've just got to Google it on the internet, is that,
or your other favorite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Yep. Or other search engines are available. But you find there that when post offices are actually moved into local stores, the range of services greatly diminishes, and also you usually find, and of course this is down to business, is that sometimes the time it takes to actually carry out post office services prevents the local store from actually doing what its core business is, and that's obviously setting.
Isn't this the way that post offices are now being used to keep them going? Is to say, if you put it in the middle of a big shop, then the big shop it gets a little bit of extra passing trade, and that allows a post office to survive, which might otherwise have to close.
I think it probably works both ways. One, if it doesn't get the trade, then the local store will say, "Look, let's cut. We don't need the post office." On the other hand, if it gets too much trade, then the local shop says, "Well, actually, my core business isn't running a post office; it's doing other things." And then again, we lose the post office, which, of course, is going to be a great concern to people in and around Cadbury Heath.
Well, I mean, South Gloucestershire Council are going to be looking at this. I mean, they'll take local people's views into account, won't they?
Yeah, the problem we face is next to the current post office, what was a local laundrette, we all fought against that laundrette. Also, South Gloucestershire actually consulted with local people on the change of use. But it always seems to be with these things. And of course, you were talking to Tim earlier on about Filton Airfield. Even though people object, those objections just seem to be completely ignored by local councillors and local politicians.
Well, hopefully not by you, Martin.
Exactly.
Martin Farmer, he's a Labour councillor for Cadbury Heath. Now, Martin, do you have any sort of online presence? Can we find you on the internet?
I don't have an online presence, but I'm on Twitter and Facebook.
Okay, lovely. Thanks very much for joining us.
Bring me a dream. Bum, 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 bum. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Bum, 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 bum. Give him two lips like roses and clover. Bum, bum, bum. And tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone. Bum, 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 bum. Don't have nobody to call my own. Bum, 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 bum. Please turn on your magic beam. Bum 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 bum. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him the word that I'm not a rover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Bum 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 bum. Mr. Sandman,
yes,
bring us the dream. Give him a pair of eyes with a come hither gleam. Give him a lonely heart like Polly Archie, and lots of wavy hair like Liberace. Mr. Sandman, someone to hold, someone to hold, would be so pity before we're too old. So please turn on your magic beam, Mr. Sandman, bring us, please, 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 Mr. Sandman, bring us all a dream.
From from my little collection of 1950s hits. You might have noticed that over the last few months I've been rolling out a few of those. That is Mr. Sandman. I'm not quite sure who the artist is. I will try it. Yes, it's Mr. Sandman by the Chordettes. Chordettes, which was a number one in the UK charts apparently sometime in the 1950s. Anyway, now I'm joined by Joanne Baker and Roz Bohill, both from the Bristol Nuclear Risk campaign, nuclearfreebristol.wordpress.com. Hi, and welcome to Drive Time, both of you.
Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Maybe you first, Roz. You're campaigning to try and get Bristol to resume nuclear-free local authority status. Now, this is something that was in the past. When was that?
In the late 80s, when they were planning to rebuild Hinkley, build a new Hinkley C then, the City Council, I believe was Avon at that point, were affiliated to nuclear-free local authorities.
Now, how did they get away with having nuclear waste coming back and forth through the city whilst they were nuclear-free? That's a difficult question for you, I can tell you.
Yes,
you're raising your eyebrows like you're not quite sure.
It's difficult because the thing about nuclear-free local authorities is that it does help to keep the local authorities informed of what's going on and of what other councils who are also part of the same group are doing about certain things, and they are also tuned into the government will actually consult them when they're proposing to do anything, any development work on the nuclear front. So it puts those authorities that are affiliated in a better position to know what's going on and possibly to influence, but it doesn't actually give them direct power to stop things.
Okay. On a personal level, what brought you to campaign on this issue?
I've been campaigning against nuclear since the early 60s as part of CND then. And yes, for a long time I wasn't that involved. And then returning to Bristol fairly recently, I met some old friends and they said, look, they're going to build Hinkley C again.
But what was the reason? I mean, obviously, you know, there was a lot of, you know, if you go back to the 1950s, 60s, 70s, it was a very, very big thing because the nuclear weapons and nuclear power was relatively new. What is it that you object to?
What I object to is the dangerousness of nuclear itself, and particularly the fact that after all this time, with the nuclear power stations particularly, there is still no way of disposing of the waste that is safe. And that's the case around the world, and certainly in this country, there isn't a safe disposal system for the waste, and maybe there never will be. And so waste is just piling up, highly dangerous waste that is going to last for hundreds of years into the future, and we don't know what to do with it. Do we want to make that worse? You know, do we want to go on doing that, creating more and more nuclear waste, whilst creating a minimal benefit from the power, in my view?
Okay, but what do you say to those like George Monbiot and others who writes for The Guardian, and they will tell you that, hang on a minute, actually, we really should be thinking about nuclear being a part of green energy in the future because of the lack of the fossil fuels that it uses and the fact that it isn't actually chucking carbon out into the environment. This is actually something quite positive about nuclear for the future.
Well, it can look like that at certain angles, but right now we don't actually need it. We're on the threshold of much cheaper renewable energy systems. There's all sorts of advances in the technologies of various different types of renewable energy.
And are you talking about windmills?
We're talking about windmills, we're talking about wave and tidal power, we're talking about solar and other systems, you know, biofuels. There are lots of different ways that are now being worked on to produce renewable energy in much safer forms than nuclear. And the fact with nuclear is that even though we may get a certain amount of benefit over a limited space of time from relatively low CO2 energy production, actually building the power stations and all the other things that go into producing nuclear power do make a lot of CO2 as well. And then you've still got this continuous waste thing, plus the possibility of an accident. Look at Fukushima. Nobody expected. In Japan, they were not expecting to have that accident, and yet it happened. It happened regardless of what their expectations and their plans were, and is now involving them, still ongoing, in billions and billions of dollars worth of money to their economy to try and stop it and to put it right.
Well, in Cablegate, which was something that Julian Assange, who's now still locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and WikiLeaks brought out, was an International Atomic Energy report a year before the Fukushima accident from the International Atomic Energy Authority to the Japanese government and to TEPCO, who operated that Fukushima plant, saying, you really better close that plant down because it's in a dangerous tsunami area. And yet that wasn't actually acted on. So I think that's maybe another part of all this, Ros, is that the information is out there, it's just being kept from the public. Joe, let's just bring you in here. You're interested in getting Bristol City Council to resume this free local authority, nuclear-free local authority status. Why is that?
Well, I think it is, as Ros says, it's to give them more clout with central government, because these policies are coming from the national level, and we in Bristol need a voice. And I think we in Bristol, more than anywhere else in the UK, need a voice, for the very reason that we have so many nuclear plants already built along the Severn Estuary. There's Hinkley, but there's also the Albury, there's one in Berkeley, which, you know, is decommissioned, but it's still there. And they're planning new ones for Hinkley and three new ones for Albury. And when you actually look on the map, this is a huge population area. You know, there's about 1 million in Greater Bristol. It will also affect Cardiff. So, you know, there's a lot of people. If there were to be an accident, if there's a lot of people whom they just could not deal with any form of evacuation of all of us. So, they're being all built on the Severn Estuary, which, as we know, is the second largest tidal range in the world, at an area where there's already global warming, there's already rising sea levels, there's already high flood risk, which the government itself says the part around Hinkley will be definitely high flood risk by.
But hang on, Joe, because yeah, there's no tsunami risk, is there?
Well, there has been one in that area.
Oh dear.
Several hundred years ago, but you know, even then, there's all sorts of things which can go wrong if these areas are in fact flooded. There's also the cyber risk. There's all kinds of things for the future, and I think
so. What's that, cyber risk?
Yeah, which is where foreign governments or people can actually stop the computer systems working, which sort of regulate all the safety issues within the nuclear power station.
Oh, I see. So this is like a virus. Hang on. This is the Stuxnet. Is that the Stuxnet? Yeah, Martin's nodding in the corner over there. The Stuxnet virus, which was targeted at the control systems of reactors in Iran. The only trouble is, of course, that these viruses don't necessarily only attack Iranian nuclear power stations. They could be transmitted around to other nuclear power stations. This is a whole nightmare for whoever's in charge of one of these plants.
Yeah, and I think it is the hundreds of years, because if they build Hinkley C, it may only last, in actual working order, 40-50 years, but then the waste there will be so hot. It's a new type of reactor, so the waste won't be transported, but it's so hot it will have to be guarded on site for another 160 years, and then they'll have to transport it, and then they may still not know what to do with it. So,
sorry, it's so hot it's got to stay there for how long?
160 years.
And this is what is this, is, site, this is the spent fuel rods, because as they come out
absolutely.
Of the reactor,
it'll be in pools, as was in Fukushima, which actually caused a great deal of the pollution there. So there's going to be a lot stored for a long time, and it is our future. You know, it's our children and grandchildren and their children that will still have to be guarding this, and we don't know how much energy and money this is going to take.
Now, I know, Joe, you've written a book about depleted uranium in Iraq, particularly, and the way that this has all sorts of birth defects. Just explain how we get from a nuclear power station like Hinkley to this depleted uranium. What is it, and how does it end up in these shells which are fired in our wars that we have?
Yeah, well, the actual DU is it's a byproduct of the nuclear industry. So it's when the uranium is enriched and they take the highly fissile part, which is only a tiny part of the uranium which they use inside the power stations, the rest is a waste, but it's still very radioactive, and this is the metal which they then put in weapons.
So it's a kind of so what's going on here is essentially as a part of the process to make a fuel rod to go into Hinkley, you end up with this uranium waste.
Yes.
That waste, rather than being treated as waste, is being given over to them, or maybe even sold, I don't know, to the military, who then put it into a
weapons
shell.
And then use it in its most dangerous form, which is to fire it and release all those minute particles into the air. And actually the interesting thing is that the recent studies in Fallujah in Iraq, where there's an incredible increase in birth deformity, they're not finding depleted uranium, but they are actually finding enriched uranium. So we don't know, we don't know which weapons this is going on, but there's also the possibility that the Americans...
So that enriched uranium, that's the stuff that should be going into the fuel rods to go in, you know, when they go into one of these power stations. Crikey, well, this is, it makes it even worse. What are your thoughts about, you know, the motives then behind Hinkley? Because it sounds to me that maybe the military are twisting the arms of the government and also of these big nuclear industry companies that build these plants, and the those types of people saying, well, actually we want a bit more of this stuff because it actually penetrates the enemy tanks really well, this, and we want some more.
I think, to be honest, there's so much stockpiled in the world today that they don't actually need anymore. They could use it for thousands of years probably, so I don't know, but there is always a very strong link between the military use of nuclear power and the civilian. And
we've heard about depleted uranium as being that link. What else?
Well, we only have the civilian use because we had the military use in the first place, and there's still a lot of research and development that's going on that affects both sides of it. So I think there is still a very strong link.
Well, because I can remember reading about plutonium, saying, well, actually, that the thing the military really love for their hydrogen bombs is this plutonium stuff, and you can only get that if you've got yourself a nuclear reactor in the first place. One does wonder if really they're interested in keeping the CO2 levels down, or whether they want to produce more of these radioactive chemicals. Anyway, Ros, back to you. What would actually change if you do get the City Council to resume its nuclear-free local authority status?
Well, I think one of the major changes we're hoping is that the council itself will become much more aware of what is going on and concerned and interested in the situation that Bristol is in, with a nuclear power station on either side of it, one to the south, Hinkley, to the north, Oldbury, both of which have got plans for new reactors, and we've got the trains going through every week, as we've said.
I mean, but are you just talking about raising awareness then? I'm just wondering, is it actually going to make any difference? We may have these nice little signs as you go into Bristol from Gloucestershire and Somerset and places saying you are now entering nuclear-free Bristol. But then these nuclear waste trains will still be going backwards and forwards through the city.
Well, the way we see it is that the more awareness there is, particularly amongst the people with power, but also amongst the general population. There are loads of people in Bristol who know nothing about either of these two nuclear power stations each side, or what they're doing or anything. So the more that is known about it, the more people will think about it and realise that perhaps the whole idea is a bad one. You know, whilst thinking in terms of trying to improve the situation for Bristol, for instance, by having an evacuation policy, by having, you know, a greater awareness of the situation should an accident occur and what can be done in those circumstances, they will begin to realise, well, actually, you know, this is pretty untenable, and increase the pressure on government to change their policy, to have a change of heart. I mean, that's the ultimate aim. But even without that change of heart, I think that there should be more greater transparency. People should know what is going on.
Okay. Also, I mean, Joe mentioned Barclay Station. I mean, we've got Oldbury, Hinkley, Barclay. Barclay closed down a few years ago. What is going on with Barclay? Have they just sort of put the whole thing in mothballs? What are they doing with all the waste?
Yes, must say that I'm ignorant as far as Barclay is concerned. I don't really know.
I wonder what they do with these old plants. You know, a nuclear power plant's closed down. You can't just sort of pull it apart and sell it for scrap, no. because, you know, it's still highly radioactive. I would imagine anyway that you've got a pressure vessel, haven't you, with a reactor inside it. You can't just sell that, take that down the local scrappy.
It's got to be guarded. Yes.
Okay. Also, Martin, old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Martin, the economics of this, we're being told, may stack up. We also had a big swap around last year with the Chinese, actually pulling out of backing the new Albury power station, and possibly some other financiers taking over. But it's a bit of a sticky one economically, isn't it?
It is, and for the reasons that have been explained by our guests, because nobody knows what to do with the waste. And in the 1990s, the Conservative government wanted to privatise the nuclear industry because they wanted to privatise everything. And when the City of London had a look at the books and realised that they would be responsible for the waste, they just said, "You're joking. Why would we want to do that?" And so, in other words, the only thing that keeps nuclear power viable is A, if the government takes care of the waste, which means that the private sector can then ignore that, which, of course, they shouldn't be able to do. Or, alternatively, of course, you've got a situation where, effectively, the nuclear industry developed on the back of the nuclear weapons industry. So we're developing nuclear weapons anyway, so we might as well have a bit of electricity on the side. But there's no real economic case for nuclear power, and whenever it's been looked at objectively, it's shown... I mean, the only reason the Japanese have got emphasis on nuclear power is because they've got no oil. It's a military strategic decision to go for nuclear power, one they're probably regretting now.
What about the CO2, though? I mean, that's one of the big arguments being used now, saying, actually, although we thought we might have to decommission these, like the Germans have done, get rid of all their nuclear power stations, actually now we've decided that in order to reach our climate change targets, that we're actually going to roll nuclear out again here in Britain, have new nuclear power stations built.
Well, just think of all those lorries driving to with ready-mixed concrete to build your nuclear power station. It's hardly emissions free, is it? And the other point, of course, is we've mentioned alternative sources of power, wind, wave and so on. The real solution to all of these problems is just be more efficient with your use of energy. It's a technology that's been well understood for a very long time. What about every house being a zero emissions house before you build it? What about making sure that we don't waste all the time? In actual fact, that's the economic solution to a lot of these problems, where the technology for doing it is absolutely clear. It's been around for a long time. We've just got to have the will to implement.
Well, there's also the incentive on all of us now. I mean, I've just paid my quarterly electricity bill, which is, they seem to be skyrocketing, going up sort of 7, 8, 9, 10% a year, if not more. And that's an incentive on us to actually use less electricity.
It is, but you actually need a plan. I mean, we need a Green New Deal.
A national plan.
Well, an international plan. I mean, we've got to save the planet, haven't we, which requires us all to cooperate.
And what about what Joe was saying there about these links to the military with depleted uranium and I mentioned the plutonium?
Well, yes, and you also mentioned the Stuxnet virus, which is fairly clearly came from the US and the Israelis, deliberately designed to trash the Iranian nuclear program. Incredibly dangerous thing to do. What a stupid thing to do, sit there and write viruses to trash nuclear power stations. And, of course, apparently the report, it was in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the report back to Obama: the good news, Mr. President, the Stuxnet virus has caused all kinds of problems for the Iranians. Hooray. The bad news, it's leaked out into the world at large and it's actually causing problems for nuclear power operators everywhere, including, so the internet gossips, Fukushima in Japan. So the problem with all complex systems, when you're dealing with very complex technology, with very dangerous, you know, byproducts, is the more complex it gets, the more things can go wrong. And, you know, the answer is to simplify what you're doing and do it more effectively.
Roz, what other cities around the country have got this nuclear-free status? Who's already got it?
Well, closest to us, of course, is Cardiff, who are also affected by the building of a new power station at Hinckley, being on the same estuary, Bristol Channel, as we are. But Manchester and various councils in the north of England are, involved. Leeds, I think, I'm not sure of the whole list, but certainly as far as we're concerned here in Bristol, I think that our councillors should be talking to councillors in Cardiff as to why they are affiliated. to this organisation, and particularly given that Bristol is aiming to become a green city and to win prizes as such, it doesn't make sense that there's nuclear power on either side of us when we're trying to build up our own use of our own production of renewables. The more money that is spent on something like nuclear power, the less there is for everything else, and that includes on energy saving as well as the production of properly green energy. Nuclear isn't green and it isn't clean.
Now, if you happen to be at Bristol Templemead Station on a Wednesday, it generally tends to be Wednesday, you may see a rather peculiar looking train go through with a sort of brown they're sort of low loader type trains with these creamy coloured flasks on with a tiny little nuclear warning sign. If you look very, very closely, you'll see it in the corner of the flask. One of the reasons I take this quite seriously is because we're told this is totally safe, whereas when I was actually stood on the platform, I swear I could actually feel that radiation coming out of the thing. You can feel it in your sort of in your fingers and in your bones. It's this kind of aching sensation. My own reaction was simply to pull back, to say, well, I'm going to go onto the other side of the platform as this thing goes past. And yet we're told these things are safe. As they're actually going down from Sellafield on the train down through Templemeads to I think it's Bridgewater, isn't it? And then they're unloaded and they go by road to Hinckley. Then they're actually quite safe. These fuel rods aren't very radioactive. For the really dangerous ones are the ones that have come out of the reactor, the spent fuel rods. They go into a pond for a year or so to cool down a bit, and then they go into one of these flasks and go up. So if you see one of these trains going through Templemead Station, if it's going from sort of south to the north of the city, from the in the direction of Swindon kind of direction, and then up towards Gloucester, in that direction in Templemead, stay well clear of the thing, that's all I would say. Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol this week asking you if you know about the Bristol nuclear trains, and if you do, what you think of them.
Are you aware that trains carrying nuclear waste are going through Bristol? And what do you think about this?
I think we should know about it. I haven't got a clue that that's going on. Pretty scary, really. Yeah, we should know about this stuff.
Yes, this is probably the safest way. I'm not afraid of it. I think nuclear is very safe. I'd be happy to build a house over a nuclear site because it's safe.
No, I don't know that. Yeah, I guess so. I guess I hadn't really thought about it before. If there is sort of a scientific evidence to suggest that, then yeah, I guess there's worry. Yeah.
No, I wasn't aware. Haven't heard anything about it. Depends if it's contained adequately, if there's regulations and it's not a problem, but if there's any chance of a leak, then of course, yeah, problem to the public.
Yes, they crash, yeah, all the time. They come through from Bridgewater up to Templemead. Stop them, take them by boat, whatever else there is. There's got to be other ways.
It's something that the government doesn't want to publicise.
Is nuclear power the way forward?
It's not a safe way to go forward at all, and everybody knows that. I think we just need to really very genuinely have a look at the impact that the nuclear power is having on our climate and is having on, you know, and having on the world. For the governments to actually open up to the much more healthy, sustainable power that's available all around us in the natural resources. They need to wake up, step up and get on with it.
Yeah, and you have to look around. It's cold. Everyone needs to be warm, don't they? So there's you need lots of energy to keep people warm and to keep cars and trains going.
I think there's a lot of room for investment in all sorts of areas. I think nuclear is probably the most efficient way to produce power. I think, yeah, we're definitely obliged to invest in the future for different types of energy sources.
Well, in this country we're a bit limited. We can't really have solar power, but wind power's an option and wave power, but price of crude oil keeps going up, then maybe nuclear is the option. There was a big campaign a few years ago to do that, but I think it's sort of gone out of the public eye a bit recently. So yeah, I think it needs to come to the forefront again of in the media.
Yeah, I think it is the way forward. There's nothing else to replace it.
I think we need a diverse energy generation, whether it comes from renewables or a mix of renewables and nuclear. We definitely have to change consumer habits, but it's the hardest thing to do and it takes a long time. I think people are becoming more aware of that as the economic crisis takes its grip and people are beginning to realise how much energy they're wasting and things. To leave an environment that's as clean as possible for our children, I guess. Unfortunately, humans are quite destructive naturally, but I think we're headed in the right direction, but a lot needs to be done from government and the whole consumer demand for oil and gas and things like that definitely needs to change.
Well, I'm not quite sure how nuclear powers cars and trains. I've not heard of actually nuclear-powered trains yet, or nuclear-powered cars. But Joe Baker, there's a big selection of views there. Probably most people saying that they didn't know about the nuclear trains, but most saying that they think that nuclear should be part of a range of different sources for energy. Basically, the idea that you shouldn't have all your eggs in one basket, like we used to do with almost all our energy being generated by coal.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an argument, but I think most people don't really understand the just how much it's going to cost financially and how much it's going to cost environmentally. And I think those things really need to be looked at and understood better, because I think our media hasn't actually given a very true picture of what it actually means for people.
Okay, well, we're trying to do that tonight. Now, Roz, finally with you, what can people do if they're interested in sort of getting this whole pressurising Bristol City Council to resume its nuclear-free local authority status?
Well, they can sign an online petition that we have, which is on the epetitionsbristol.gov.uk /epetition site, and they can look it up. They can have a look at our own site, which is nuclearfreebristol.wordpress.com, and on there is the link to the petition. And part of the petition is also to encourage the mayor to re-enliven his role as a mayor for peace. And you could join the South West Against Nuclear campaign, or the Stop Hinkley campaign. There are several campaigns, and all the links are on that website that I've given you, nuclearfreebristol.wordpress.com.
Okay, that's lovely. Thank you very much for joining us, Roz Bohill and Joanne Baker.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, back by popular demand this week is the outspoken intelligence and security commentator and barrister Michael Shrimpton. Whatever you may think of his claims over previous weeks about BBC presenter Jimmy Savile colluding with former Tory Prime Minister Ted Heath to sexually abuse and murder young boys on Heath's famous sailing boat Morning Cloud from the Hôtel de la Grenne Children's Home, those are just allegations, even though Heath is dead. One has to wonder why Thames Valley Police Special Branch saw fit to raid his home in an attempt to stop his forthcoming book Spy Hunter being published. Anyway, this week we look at the notorious murder of government scientist David Kelly, who was briefing Andrew Gilligan at the BBC Today programme. The dodgy dossier, which said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction ready to be used in minutes, had been sexed up by Tony Blair and the Director General of MI6, John Scarlett. Well, Lib Dem MP Norman Baker wrote the definitive book on David Kelly's death, The Strange Death of David Kelly, which spells out many anomalies in the official story of Kelly's suicide. By coincidence, David Kelly's body was found in the same police force area, Thames Valley, as Shrimpton now lives, which makes the police raid to stop his book being published doubly suspicious. First, the police have no right to censor books or raid writers and journalists and shut them up. And secondly, that the book pointed to possible criminal failings and even serious organised crime going on within Thames Valley Special Branch itself. Anyway, into that toxic mix, barrister Michael Shrimpton also pours another motive for Kelly's murder, on top of the fact that he was exposing the Prime Minister and MI6 colluding to start an illegal war in Iraq. And that, Michael Shrimpton believes, was his knowledge of missing nuclear weapons being circulated around the world on the black market.
In fairness to David, he had a conversation with Andrew Gilligan off the air, off record, and Andrew Gilligan then used him as a source. Of course, David was murdered after the Iraq War. The timeline was that we had the Iraq War in March 2003. In May, major operations then ended, and after that we had a counterinsurgency war. But the Republic of Iraq as an enemy had been defeated. And the motive for the murder, I didn't think was anything to do with the sexed up dossier. I think everybody's focused on Iran. It's perfectly clear he was murdered. Everybody's focused on Iraq, understandably, because he'd been out in Iraq as a weapons inspector. The real motive, however, is to do with Iran, not Iraq. David had become aware, and I explained this in Spy Hunter, David had become aware, although listeners are hearing this for the first time on a British radio station, David Kelly had become aware from sources in GO2 in London that the French had agreed to covertly ship some of their plutonium stockpile to Iran in order to allow Iran to acquire nuclear weapons in order to deter an Anglo-American attack on Iraq. Now, I was party to some of the discussions which led to the Iraq war, and I was fully au fait with the strategic thinking in Washington, and that strategic thinking, well, in fact, I actually met the general who was supposed to be in charge of the occupation. Of course, once he was pulled and the State Department put in charge, I knew it was a disaster in the making. Never put State Department in charge of anything, no offence intended. To state, love them to bits, but you don't put them in charge of an occupied territory after a war. They're bound to stuff it up. Should have been left with the Pentagon. The intention always was to swing into Iran. Iraq was perfect as a springboard for knocking out Syria, where you had another Ba'athist dictator in Assad, and knocking out Iran, where you had a dictatorship with Ahmadinejad. Now, there was absolutely no...
Well, hang on a minute. He's actually a democratically elected leader.
Depends on your view of Iranian elections. In truth, the Iranian election results are even dodgier than the 1975 EEC referendum.
But you can say the same about US election results, for example. You can say a lot... You yourself have criticised the leadership of the British political parties.
Well, I do. Ohio, certainly. The American election result in 2012 in Ohio does look rigged. There seems to have been, in some districts in Ohio, the vote for President Obama was more than the number of registered electors. So, I don't mean registered Democrats, I mean registered electors. So you had a voting in some districts, reportedly, of over 100%. The Ohio result certainly looks very dodgy, and strong indications of electoral fraud there.
Okay, but anyway, back to Kelly.
Exactly. Well, I view Ahmadinejad as a dictator, but you can describe him as elected president if you wish. In practice, he's not the key man in power in Iran anyway. He's more of a figurehead than people realize. But the decision was taken by Germany and France to arm Iran with nuclear weapons in order to prevent an Anglo-American liberation of Iran. And the weapons were to be plutonium-cored weapons. Plutonium was chosen because the Iranian delivery systems, which were the Shahab rocket, were basically too small and too low power to take uranium weapons. Your plutonium weapon is a lot more compact, which means it's lighter, and you can get it into the air with a smaller delivery system. The French had the world's largest stockpile, still do, of weapons-grade plutonium. The French have a big black stockpile. I actually briefed in El Baradei on this, although he didn't do anything with it, apart from use the intelligence for his own purposes. No offence intended to Mohammed. Nice chap, but not very effective as director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The French covert plutonium shipments were designed for one purpose only. There was weapons-grade plutonium. It was going out to France. It went out to Iran from France, actually in German submarines. It was landed at Bandar Abbas. The whole purpose of that operation was to give Iran nuclear weapons, and Iran has and has had for several years at least 30 operational nuclear warheads. The plutonium is French. The warhead design came from China. The Chinese were in on it. They gave the Iranians an old Chinese MIRV, a multiple independent re-entry vehicle. Most modern nuclear weapons, you don't have a single warhead. You have a number of smaller warheads in a cone at the top of the missile. The fuel and so on doesn't re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. It's only the cone of your ballistic missile which re-enters the atmosphere. Most modern warheads are not a single warhead, but what we call MIRVs, and you have multiple warheads. And the nasty thing about multiple warheads from a nuclear counter-proliferation perspective is that the MIRV warheads are quite small and can go onto a much smaller missile. That gives countries that are not technologically advanced, like Iran, all of a sudden they've got an intermediate-range ballistic missile capability. They're sticking one small MIRV warhead onto a smaller rocket, and you've got yourself a pretty deployable IRBM with enough range to hit Israel.
So what you're saying essentially is they took a big ballistic missile, broke down those individual components, and they've now got little, smaller, medium-range atomic weapons.
Instead of having three or four small warheads on a big missile, what the Iranians did was take one small warhead, one of the small warheads, and put them on a small missile. They certainly have the warheads, 30 on last count, all fully operational, all thanks to a French plutonium shipment after the Iraq war, about which David Kelly was fully informed. Now, the nasty thing about the Kelly murder is not just that he was murdered, it was absolutely disgraceful, but that he was tortured before he was murdered. The reason that nobody saw him between the time he left home and the time his body was found early the following morning is because he was kidnapped, taken to a German GO2 safe house in Essex, tortured overnight to find out how he'd acquired the intelligence on the plutonium shipment, which is at that stage very, very quiet, and then the body was dumped. Of course, Thames Valley Police, being complete idiots, no offence intended, Thames Valley Police got themselves into a blew the gaff by shifting the body and adding in the knife and the bottle of water, and whichever idiot Rosa left the knife by the body. When the body was dumped, it was all done in a rush. I think he died under torture, and he had a heart attack. He did have a cardiac condition. They were torturing him, as sometimes happens when you're torturing people. I don't, of course, barristers are not allowed to torture people, but as sometimes happens when people are being interrogated under torture, if they've got a cardiac complication, then you lose your suspect. It's one of the reasons why you don't torture people. And it's an idiotic method of doing interrogations. The Germans do torture. They were torturing Kelly. Poor old chap snuffed it. They had to then try and make out that he died by suicide. But because he'd snuffed it unexpectedly, in my view, everything was done in a panic. They gave the game away by injecting him with paracetamol and dextropropoxifene in the wrong ratio. The idea was to create the impression that he'd swallowed some tablets of coproximol. Well, we knew he hadn't swallowed tablets of coproximol because, as you probably know, with most people realise that when you have a tablet, if you've only got to look at the box and see the ingredients. If you look at the small print, it will tell you that the tablet will have inactive ingredients as well as the active drugs. That's because most drugs in their natural state are in liquid form. Most tablets will have inactive ingredients simply in order to get a tablet. The inactive ingredients of the drug will normally be in the stomach contents. Since they weren't, other than a third of a tablet, it was perfectly clear he hadn't swallowed coproximol. More than that, the paracetamol dextropropoxifene ratio in the blood work was inconsistent with coproximol. In coproximol, the drugs are the ratio of 10 of paracetamol to 1 of dextropropoxifene. I should explain to listeners that I didn't have any notice of the question, so it'd been a little while since I looked at the file, and probably about a year since I wrote the chapter on the Kelly assassination in Spy Hunter. But the paracetamol dextropropoxifene ratio in the tablets is 10 to 1. They metabolize in the bloodstream at about the same rate. You might get a ratio of 9 to 1 or 11 to 1. A pathologist isn't going to be too worried if it's not exactly 10 to 1, because it's never going to be exactly 10 to 1. What it strongly suggests is that the idiots who were putting together the drugs and mixing them in a large bore needle to inject the drugs in the site, which was then covered up with the puncture wound was covered up by the cut to the ulnar artery, that when they were mixing the drugs, they just got the ratio wrong. You can just imagine two GO2 guys, you know, saying, what's the ratio? Oh, it's 10 to 1. No, it's 100 to 1. Oh, what is it? And these guys didn't have any medical training. They weren't doctors. If they were doctors, they probably wouldn't have lost their chap under torture in the first place. And you don't get registered doctors with the General Medical Council attending torture sessions to look after the patient. It's the sort of thing the GMC tend to form a view about. I'm sure my learned friend Alison Foster will tell you that. She used to prosecute for the GMC. It's one of the things that can get you struck off is supervising the torture of a British intelligence officer at the request of German intelligence to make sure he doesn't die under torture. Poor chap snuffs it. They clearly cock it up, if listeners will forgive the expression, and the drugs go into the bloodstream in the ratio of 100 to 1, not 10 to 1, giving the game away to anybody who understands blood work and toxicology and, you know, has some forensic skill, giving the game away, certainly completely excluding suicide as the cause of death, because otherwise there is no rational explanation for the coproximol packet.
If these people were to do this torture to Kelly, he would then talk about it afterwards. I mean, surely the idea was to kill the guy. I mean, you know, isn't that ultimately what the whole point is?
Oh, yes. It's the same with the paedophile. When Edward Heath was abusing boys, they had to be murdered to prevent them talking. Obviously, they were going to murder David Kelly. My point is that I think one can't be absolutely certain, and we won't be certain until we break open the GO2 files. For that, we're going to have to organise a serious raid on GO2's headquarters, which are in a quiet little part of Vauxhall Cross. as one or two of the senior boys in MI6 know, and will tell you over a drink if you ask them nicely and promise not to tell anybody. And the chaps doing the torture have probably themselves since been eliminated. That's the usual practice of GO2 and the Jerrys. Or, sorry, our community partners, the Jerrys, as we're in the EU. The intent was clearly to murder him, although that there could be no question. My view is he died unexpectedly. There are certainly signs of complete panic and things being rushed, basic things like forgetting to get his fingerprints on the knife. I mean, that was another giveaway. Obviously, if you stab yourself to death with a knife, you're going to leave your fingerprints on it. The idea that you cut your wrist and then wipe the fingerprints off the knife as the last thing you do on earth before you snuff it is just ridiculous, and it has to be stated for its absurdity to be apparent.
Michael Shrimpton there, barrister, and also supposed correspondent on intelligence, Martin Summers. What about this theory he's got there about the French getting plutonium off to the Iranians? Is there any kind of plausibility in that?
Well, I would just point out that the French certainly did not like the invasion of Iraq, and the French Secret Service definitely did brief journalists that bin Laden met with the CIA station chief on July the 4th, 2001, in Dubai. So the idea that the Germans and the French might be trying to frustrate the British and the Americans, not entirely unbelievable.
Okay, finally on Davos, this article is entitled Davos's Dubious Strategic Partners, really looking at some of the people that run it, and this guy James Gibney, I'll put a link up on the website because we haven't really got much time now, but what they're saying essentially is that some of the people who are organising this Davos conference are some of the worst tax evaders, tax avoiders and crooks and criminals in the world.
I'm shocked. I can't believe such a thing.
Okay, well, anyway, that's all for this week. Next week, we've got Gary McFarlane as a Bristol man who was sacked from his job for his Christian faith. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, and Pat Cyrus at 0117 955 3721. Cyrus the Virus is up next. See you next week. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Barry George, the man wrongly convicted of murdering Jill Dando, has lost...